Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Ice-T. I want you to do something for me. Make sure you download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Ioncal. It is official. All right? Stop playing. Download and subscribe Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Ioncal. It's cold.
Actress, MC, co-signed by KRS-One when she was a teenager, hip-hop pioneer. She's Michie Mee, and I want to welcome her to Library Rap, the hip-hop interviews with Tim Ioncal. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a shame there's not a day rough like this when Michie's on this mic. It's not niceness. Those who diss the miss and pretend to be behind my back and then I'm
so I know we want to talk about the new album, but you know, I always love to ask you, you know, you're known as, you know, the quote is Canada's first notable female MC, right? So but who were your influences you know, growing up? And also, were there artists out there that maybe, you know, within Canada or within the community that maybe weren't noticeable, quote unquote, Canada's notables, but actually had such a profound influence on you and kind of wish they kind of made it, you wish they kind of made it more, but they unfortunately didn't?
Well, in the scene in Canada, there was no scene. Like when we actually came on the scene, there was like a little bit of, you know, the parks and the introduction of just block parties and so forth. But there were female MCs that were on sound systems. They weren't necessarily doing songs. When I came into the scene, I was more looking at the Beat Street, at the Debbie Dab, Sha Rocks, and Lisa. We were looking at movies. I was very young, so I wasn't allowed out to at the block parties prior. Mm. So I'm aware of MCs in the scene. But when we actually came on the scene, that's when the battle raps was in. That's when the urban music scene actually formed in Canada. So I didn't have much influences for Canada. I was always in the U.S. Prior to the hip-hop scene here due to family and traveling with my high school peers. Mm-hmm. And when we were there, we would hang out at Latin Quarters. And we were hanging out in the Bronx and visiting family there. So we would travel to the scene up the street, whether it was Stardust, or whether it was hopping on a train and going to Manhattan. So we were influenced by the Shantays. We were influenced by the MC Lights, Salt and Peppers. Like when it became a little bit mainstream, meeting the underground scene, that's when I was very intuitive and came from Canada to the U.S. and was trying to tell them that, you know what, there's some hip hop in Canada. We're Canadian. And nobody would really recognize the fact that hip-hop was in Canada. They were just intrigued by there was a girl from Canada here, and here she is speaking Jamaican. She sounds different, but her accent's very Jamaican. So it was a hard pill to sail, but it definitely it worked out.
You mentioned you're born in Jamaica. You lived in Canada. There's obviously reggae and two different styles of music and two different amazing styles of music, and you obviously have this connection and you've been drawn to both styles, and you hear that in your music. So can you like briefly talk about what drew you to reggae, and also what actually drew you to hip-hop and hip-hop culture?
Well, the very first album, Jamaican Funk, Canadian Style, one side was hip-hop and one side was reggae. I always wonder if people remember that. So I was always kind of doing both, and that was because I was very influenced. My father was in the concert promoting scene in Jamaica and was one of the promoters that helped bring the Jackson 5 to Jamaica and Isaac Hayes to Jamaica and all the Motown affiliates to Jamaica. So there was a lot happening there. So my very first stage show, before I came to Canada, I have these pictures of me backstage, and they were called the Jackson 5 at the time. So what drew me to reggae was my father's being in the business and me just eye-opening seeing performances live on stage and being backstage at a very young age. Coming to Canada and seeing poetry on TV, seeing poetry at my school, seeing me writing a lot of poetry in grade 8. My teacher was very intrigued by my writing, and here we go with this popular song that crossed the border real quick, was Rapper's Delight. Mm-hmm. And that influenced everybody. So it was like, oh my God, they're telling a story about you know, the hood, the streets. And at that time, there was no one that would believe there was street culture in Toronto. And I was coming from a very dancehall Jamaican scene. So the grassroots scene, even in Canada, for the hardcore was very dancehall. So that I was living in dancehall, but writing hip hop. So I was always in the reggae scene, period. And so that was, you know, it was a cool thing to be a part of, but not knowing that there was a difference, or there was supposed to be a difference, or I just looked at it as one scene. But going to New York, that's where I would go to soak up more of the hip hop. Mm. And in Canada, I'd be all over the dance hall and reggae. So when you put me in a booth, they both came out.
you just mentioned Rapper's Delight, and I know you've told the story about how you had the opportunity to listen to that because your mom used to go on trips, and she, that was one of the pieces of music she brought back from her trip.
Yep. That's how you know I'm not lying. Same story.
when you told your parent, or you told your mom, you said, I want to do this, you know, I want to do what Rapper's Delight does. What was her reaction? And then what has kind of been her impact on you in terms of as an artist?
Oh, we didn't tell mom. Mom was at work. Why tell mom? Why would we tell mom we're doing what grown men do? And then there's a dance attached to this call. It's called break dancing. And I'm going to be doing windmills. Why would we tell mom all of that? We waited till mom went to work. It was firecrackers outside. All the kids at the rec center would join and be like, we're going to go firecrackers. I'd act like I'm making a firecracker. I'm going out there to rhyme in the park and battle boys. It was crazy. So mom had no idea what was going on. She got wind of it on when Much Music, when I officially had gotten the deal, and Much Music put me on TV, and her friends in the cafeteria, I'm sure, were like, she looks familiar. Is that Michelle? Yes, mother. And, you know, auntie squeals on me. She's at the rec dancing with the boys on the floor. I'm going to tell the same story, but yes. So I didn't tell mom. She found out. And then, you know, some of the historical pictures that I see of me, it's so funny because I would take her clothes. And I was, you know, you get busted in hindsight because we had no social media.
Right.
Yeah. So it was hilarious to see that. But no, we didn't tell mom. Mom just seen her clothes and me on TV.
That's awesome.
And pictures.
I want to ask you more about the Canadian background, but also and the Jamaican background, in the sense that, you know, you talked to, I interviewed El DeSensei of the Artifacts, and he talked, and he's from New Jersey, right? So he used to talk about how in the early days, like late 80s, early 90s, that they used to kind of hide the fact that they were from New Jersey when they came to New York.
Absolutely.
Was there ever, I imagine you coming from Canada, was there ever that, did you have to do that move? Did you have to kind of pretend you, and when you went to visit New York, for example, did you try to hide the fact that you were, you know, quote unquote, out of towners?
Oh, well, I was Jamaican, so that made me international. So when I was nice. In Brooklyn, I represented Brooklyn, Jamaica. When I was in the Bronx, Jamaica. I was in, you know, Queens, Jamaica. So my common denominator over there was Jamaica. And then they'd be like, where do you live? And then I would say Canada. Hmm. So it's very, because they can always tell from the accent. But the first thing, they thought my Canadian accent even sounded Jamaican, like more Jamaican at that time. So it was just, I always hid behind where it was, and it depends, because when you travel to the U.S., I was actually going to a scene. So I would either go to a hip-hop scene directly, or I'm going to the dance hall. I'd be at Biltmore Ballroom. I'd be at anywhere that I could find any party, any you know, the bars that were entertaining music. So there was, you know, when I went to a certain scene, the common denominator was always West Indian culture. And then I would try to get on the list, the guest list of all the parties. And yeah, and that was it. And I would hang out a lot and drag MC Peaches to all the, my label mate at the time, also on First Party. I would drag her to, you know, to dances with me, and she would always take me and get me into the industry parties and swatch. And there was a whole group of people in the U.S. that was, they before they were icons, were actually still spreading themselves throughout the scene too. Mm. So it was very, you know, me being a fresh face in the scene, it was easy for them to kind of say, come with us and protect me. So yeah, it was cool upbringing in the scene. It was very protective of out of towners, but we all hid. We were from out of town. Everyone wanted to be from New York.
Right.
Everybody.
We all know that. I mean, the godfather of hip hop is Kool Herc, and he's from Jamaica, right? Was there ever, I'm just curious, was there ever any blowback from, how did the Jamaican community embrace you as when you didn't, when not the Jamaican funk style for you, but the kind of the Canadian style for you. Was there, did they embrace it, or was there a little blowback at all from them?
No, not at all. Because a lot of immigrants were here. So they knew of the culture. The fact that I was brave enough to put it into music or in a rap battle, like, oh my God, no, she didn't. Because hip hop had an accent. So hip hop is very American. And then here I come putting on a whole other dialect into it. So Canada knew that was the way that we talked. So as soon as I did it, it was embraced. That's why my first album, to be different in the American culture, was easiest to do one side reggae and one side hip hop. And I got to work with the American, Jamaican greats that ended up producing Mikey Bennett, who went in, and Stephen Stanley, and these people worked with Shabba Ranks, and then he won the first Grammy. So I was a part of a very early team, even in the reggae production area, that helped me put my reggae sound together and the Canadian American hip hop, because hip hop had an accent, sound together and complete a full album. So yeah, it was very relevant in the scene. It wasn't seen as deemed as something new to the industry, but not new to the hardcore party goers. Because the way that I started doing it was just going to parties and being myself, and everybody giving me a mic because they knew, you know, I'm a love microphone.
I think what's great is that, you know, you started your career at the you started performing, I'm sorry, at the age of 14. Looking back, I just imagine what I was doing at the age of 14, which is not much. Do you think, is that too early to start a career looking back? Or is it just, was it at a time where you just had to take, the opportunity came, you had to go with it?
Well, you had to go with it because hip hop wasn't a genre yet. It was, you know, a secret. It was the word. It was a rumor. It was something that was, you know, was intriguing the young people because their parents were having parties that we couldn't go in the other room because we're playing disco out there and we had to go to bed. So it was, okay, well, now there's this new stuff and these guys are younger and maybe, you know, times are changing and there's not as many jobs and these things are being reflected in the music and it's trickling down and crossing the borders and we're telling similar stories. We're not being heard because we do not and did not have an infrastructure. So how dare us tell any of those stories here. So we had to be hardcore fans. So, yeah.
I mentioned in the intro, you had two incredible co-signs early in your career, which was the legendary KRS-One and the late Scott LaRock of Boogie Down Productions.
Yes.
How did you connect with them? But two, at the time of your connecting with them, what were they to you in terms of, what did they mean to you in terms of the culture and the music?
We all knew who BDP was. And then I met them at Latin Quarters. So that's where I met Scott and Chris. And the story goes, you know, hey, there's this girl, she's saying she can rap. She's from Canada. Ain't she cute? And, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm cute. You want to hear me rap? And off I went. And, you know, they're from the Bronx. I'm from the follow everybody home. So it was just, and then they came to Canada. They always wanted to come to Canada because they didn't believe me. So we used to always debate on that because I was like returning to Canada. Probably that was my flyout weekend. And then they came to Canada. So BDP was, like I said, these were friends that I turned into icons. Mm-hmm. We were all just, you know, being a part of the culture and trying to tell Much Music, like, you know, Scott was on Much Music saying he's a businessman. He's, you know, he's educated. He's so forth. I'm here because the music is here. And he was explaining to people, and there was no, to them, educated. It was such a shock that there was an educated man coming with hip hop and saying he's a record company. That was news at that time. So, you know, these were my friends that were now icons, you know, legends, resting in peace. Yeah, so it was just, we didn't look at it that way. We were really trying to prove that, you know, they need a category for this.
Run for Cover, produced by Scott LaRock and KRS-One from Break It Out compilation. You listen to it then and you listen to it now, and it's just like such a, you know, this great and obvious like BDP influence on it, but also the reggae influence as well. Do you think these kind of influences, if you look at today's hip hop, are missing in terms of, I guess, you know, what it meant to have this type of sound on a record?
I wouldn't say anything is missing because there's so much options. It just depends on what rises to the top and what we see, because I think it's all there. There's so many pieces of hip hop now. There's so many generations of it. There are no missing pieces. It's just who's putting it out, who the fans and people that are consuming music are listening to. So in terms of what's now, I think the kids just like what they liked, and you know, you like what you like in hip hop, because not everybody liked the same kind of hip hop. Even when we were growing up, everyone had a different style of voice. There was a time when, you know, if you liked NWA, could you like BDP? It was like totally different, but we consumed it all, especially being Canadians. We were just like, oh my God, there is a difference, and that's okay. Now there's so much similarity, so it would seem like something is missing. I just think in terms of what's popular is how you could filter out things as deemed missing, but it's all there. I just think whoever is on that level of magnifying the scene would magnify something else, or you know, or if the consumers gravitated to it more, we would see it more. Mm-hmm. But in terms of missing, I do think every element of hip hop is being done across the board, across the world. It's a new time now, so we will see. There's many generations involved in hip hop. It's not just one generational no more. So just seeing hip hop grow up is just a great thing to see. So I think whatever is considered being missing, you're going to see in the elders, because some of it can't leave. It hasn't come out of us yet as artists. So we're back. We're back.
you look at your career and you think about the cosigns, you think about your debut album, you think about just now talking about hip hop and hip hop culture. And then you continue to look at your career, and then you get to Ragga Death. I think I listened to it, and I think it's great as well. And how did that come to be? Like, how did you go from Jamaican funk and Canadian style to that?
Well, before that, I went to makeup art school, and I wanted to, you know, you always got to find a job, got to do whatever. So I went to get a grant to do my OSAP and do my school loan and my makeup art and be a makeup artist. And I'm going to help all the urban artists look cute on TV. And down the street was a studio, Wellesley Studio, and that's where myself and MC Light recorded when we were here in Toronto. And there was an engineer, Walter, there, and Walter called Steve. Steve was here from England, and they were putting a band together with Paul Raven, may he rest in peace, and they wanted a they wanted a rapper, period, on rock punk stuff, and it had a lot of reggae and ska to it. And they had a lot of people come to the studio, and I just happened to be one of them, and the singles that I wrote, they gravitated to, and then I would call on another writer. Specs from Dream Warriors came in and helped the project, and off we went, and by the time I looked, we were three albums deep, and I was the main singer on the singles, but we had like three or four vocalists that would be in the band when we performed live. They would call us Spinal Tap, but we went to the UK because there were so many of us. And we were so crazy. So yeah, there was a couple other vocalists too on the other tracks. The singles that people gravitated to was the ones that I was on. So it was one of the coolest experiments, especially live, was refreshing. And I got to go on a lot of punk rock tours in Canada, here with Biff Naked and SNFU were punk rock bands. So that was an experiment that shocked everybody.
What did that allow you to do? What did the rock music or the punk rock music allow you to do that hip hop? I don't know if confined is the right word, but kind of, maybe limited you in terms of writing or in terms of even a live performance?
Well, it let me find the routes in Canada. I got to know that there was other places you could perform, and those pockets loved hip hop too. So that's one thing that I got. And by the time the tour was over, anybody that was into ska or rock and roll was doing hip hop moves, and I was jumping up and down like a rock person, rockhead. So it was like, well, not a rockhead, rock person. Watch for words. Yeah, I was rock and rolling like a hardcore rock fan, and you know what I mean. And the rock fans were jumping up and down like hip hop. So it was nice. It was a nice, you know, it was refreshing. I mean, no one knew what to expect, but everyone wanted to be there and be a part of it.
I think as an American who loves music and who like in the 90s went through this phase of if it was on the radio, I couldn't stand listening to it type thing. And obviously that's where I like get underground, and then you get to listen to Black Star and all those guys. But You there was a hope that there would always be these artists that you loved, you would hear on the radio. And then, you know, prior to doing research for this interview, and I come across the Canadian radio and TV law about 35% of Canadian artists had to be played on the airwaves, because I know there was a time that it was like British and American artists were being, or music were being dominated on the Canadian airwaves, which is obviously unfair to Canadian artists. Can you talk about kind of that that law a little bit and why it came to be? Then also, in your mind, how do you think that helped, and how do you think maybe even hurt some of the Canadian artists?
Well, I don't even think the fact that they had to put a number on it was that they didn't believe there was a lot of us here to actually form a scene. Mm-hmm. And that's understandable because the genre was new. So that's part of the growing pains that we had. So it helped us when you knew that you had to be played. So you had to qualify at least to recording levels as worldwide music to be played and to be recognized. So it made artists kind of bring their level to level up and just kind of get their production together, get their teams together and help form an infrastructure here. Mm-hmm. It hurt us because we still don't get radio. No matter what the number is, it would have been 17% being played. Mm. It gave us a seat at the table, but wasn't fulfilling because we couldn't fix the other things to get us to the table. So there's many ways to look at it. Like it didn't hurt, but it didn't help. Mm-hmm. It was just a number to some. It didn't make sense because we still didn't have the marketing money in terms of independent artists to put music to fulfill that percentage on radio. Mm-hmm. So to a lot of people, it was just numbers. We were still just creating the art in the art form and the genre.
Do you think, I mean, you know, there's obviously the popularity of someone like Drake. Do you think, I know that it doesn't sound like the laws were helpful at all, but do you think even someone like the popularity of Drake, does that even kind of make the laws, I guess, a little less impactful because now you have Drake on the radio, so it just covers that anyway?
Well, Drake brought radio home to Canada. That's what he did. He let it, you know, he let the world know that there's artists that qualify for radio from Canada.
So
it's just like if you invest in the right artist, you will get results. And he just continued to grow. So he added to the fact that, yeah, there's some pretty talented people here. And whether they go through Drake or not, it's, you know, there's a whole bunch of them. And I'm glad he brought radio here. He brought the world's eyes on radio, streaming, anything, the marketing, the young black men, the scene here, the what's going on here, how does it relate to cash money in New Orleans, how the two cultures get together, money. Just seeing everything we got to see through Drake's growth.
Mm, so I wanted to take you to a Sound Academy in Toronto on September 2nd, 2012. You're invited on stage with Maestro Shresh Fresh by Public Enemy. Can you talk about that night, but also, I only got to watch it through a YouTube video, but, what is it? What has PE meant for you as an artist and on your career?
Oh, the Lifesavers, the original Lifesavers, PE is just a treasure in itself. The mentorship, the guidance, everything about the Billy. I remember that show. I had gotten a call. The maestro called me and said, "Are you going to this show?" "Yeah, I'm going." "Yeah, I'm coming." "All right, put your name on the list." And then down we went. And then Chuck calls us on stage, and the rest is history. Maestro blew the crowd away because he was rapping about one of our mayors that was doing naughty stuff. And may he rest in peace. But you know, there was a lot going on in the scene. So it was PE. Just no matter where I'm at in my career, I always seem to, you know, lend that hand to all of us and just never forgets the foundation of Canadian hip hop, like the maestros and mishis, never leaves us out, whether we're in the arena, whether we have projects that has dropped and we want collabo, we want mentorship, we want to open up for the show. They always have a way of making sure that the foundation artists in Canada are taken care of. So I love my PE. I love my S1Ws. No matter what they are and what they do, they just love me right back.
That's awesome. So the next question I'm going to ask you is, and I'm going to list female artists, but I'm not necessarily asking, you don't have to respond saying, oh, you don't have to respond about with more female artists' name. You could also, of course, please say male artists. And this will make sense to you after I ask you the question.
cool.
So listen to your music. And I was texting, flatline this as this was happening, but I was like, oh, she sounds
big up flatline.
I was like, she sounds like, I mean, I was like, artists I hear when I hear Michi, I hear Miss Dynamite, Lauryn Hill, Rhapsody, Sir Rock. And I was like, wow, she's influenced. And I was like, she's influenced a lot of them. And I think that's the conversation that we always fail to have is when we do like top 10 artists, we always fail to have, we like to say an artist, but then we forget to mention who obviously influenced them. When you hear those artists, who do you hear? Like, who do you think, I guess, who do you hear in terms of influences, whether they're other female artists or even male or male artists?
When I hear the artists that you mentioned?
Yeah.
Oh man, I love them all. I'm just glad that they're all different.
Yeah, definitely.
And we needed that in the female light. Like, we needed that. Who do I hear that sounds similar to me, or who influenced me that I sound like, or who do I hear in me, or who do I?
I guess who? Yeah, I mean, that's good. Who do you hear in yourself, and then who do you hear in other artists that?
Well, anybody who knows me knows my favorite artist is Roxanne Shanté. Okay, I just love Shani. I mean, Batty Al's Revenge is based on my favorite records, Roxanne's Revenge.
That's awesome.
I threw it out there just as, you know, people are like, oh my God, who are you revenging? Who are you saying? I'm like, ah, ha, 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 you don't know hip hop. So, you know, and I brought it back to a powerful female MC. I love my Salt and Pepper because they were the performance queens. And Lauryn Hill, you just can't leave out. You know what I mean? She just brought that roots and culture that is just always embedded in me, period. She's even influenced me to even want to bring it out more. You know, just because them trouble Lauryn, when a trouble Lauryn. So I love my Lauryn Hill, I love my Foxy Brown, and I love my Little Kim. Little Kim is like the badness. Mm-hmm. Foxy's the badness, the realness, the hardcore. And you know, and my MC Light, you can't leave out Light. That's a general. That's who I was on the road with when I was out there in First Priority, with First Priority. So a lot of my golden era sisters, Latifah just always had my back. So she has this, it's more of her moniker is who I look up to and look, you know, along. I'm just so proud of her. Yeah, so those are my down. But, you know, you can't leave out the Sister Nancy's. I love my Sister Nancy's. You can't leave out my Lady Anne's, my you know, my the hardcore, the back in the days, MC's, the Lady G's. They're the ones that also had the influences from Canada, the Carla Marshalls. Just the dance hall girls that were out at the time. Maka Diamond at that time was Lady Mackerel, Lady P, Sister Charmaine, may she rest in peace, who has recently passed, just recently. So those were the artists that I would see on the stage and really, really perform and add my hip hop element to it.
That's dope. I was listening to the and watching the video of Bad Gal's Bubble. And it's a track that you simply just destroy.
thank you.
It's just like it's and the video is also, you know, the video is just as powerful as, you know. And I what I really love about it, and this is obviously not the first time you do this, but and you is the switching of styles in between the track. How do you plan that out? How do you plan in terms of like going from hip hop to dancehall reggae, and just knowing what lyrics call for what?
You know what? Sometimes I don't. It's a lot of freestyle energy. Sometimes it's very in the moment. But it depends. I'm telling a story. So when you're telling a story and you get to the high point of the pivotal moment in that story, sometimes it's frustrating. And the more anger or the more I'm in the battle mode, the accent comes out. It's like when you go back to your native tongue when you're pissed. So I stay pissed a lot in the reggae, the dance hall, and use it more on the battle element. So it depends on the story I'm telling, where the accent comes in and what is, you know, what's running the road now in terms of things that people are saying. And it's usually, there's always some slang. So you can always just interject your slang when you're, you know, you're describing the moment or letting someone have it, letting somebody know what time it is. And it doesn't always have to be aggressive. It doesn't have to be the badness all the time. But, you know, that's the fun part in it. That's when, you know, people listen to it, is when you're being that aggressive dancehall. You know, dancehall has that energy. So, yeah, so it's kind of depends on the story you're telling and how comes the accent.
So if sometimes it is just kind of spur of the moment or freestyle, how does the...
Absolutely.
How does the production work then?
I mean, they're on their own. They can't even read. just send me the beat and turn on the mic and, you know, I would just take it from there. So once I get the beat, once I get in the zone, once I ready up, it's a whole other thing. You have to just rhythm up and just let me go. So I really just really enjoy telling a story. So it depends on the moment in the story. You know, falling in love, falling out of love, pissed off at love, mad at him, mad at her, pissed off at the industry. Whose fault is it? And, you know, you just give it to them.
So, let's turn to the new album, Bad Girls.
Yes.
Bad Girls Revenge. You know, told me the significance of the title, but I wanted to ask you about the first, not the first track with Chuck D on it, but the first track, Forgot About Me.
Yeah.
That beat just kind of creeps up on you. And then,
yes.
And I, you know, as I mentioned, it's kind of, as I have an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old, and for some reason, it reminded me of like a lullaby kind of beat.
Yes.
In a weird, maybe sick way. I don't know.
Could you, scary movie way.
Scary movie way. Yes. I see dead people.
I'm coming to get you. Did you forget about me?
You know, yeah, like a, you know, a Freddy Krueger lullaby way.
Yes. The awakening. Come here, children. You think it's a story, and then I say, well, you know, start swearing in the chorus. Right.
It's like very, very, very Jean Grey.
Yeah, so I love her too.
Oh, she's great. Yeah,
yeah, man.
Can you talk about this this track kind of being essentially being the opening track of the album?
Yes. Well, I, you know, truly thought and sometimes believe the whole world forgot about me. So it's just kind of letting everyone know this is the reasons and, you know, this is what happened. I mean, look at me. Imagine what they did to your dad, kind of stuff. So it was kind of telling a bit of every story. In point form over a storytelling beat and just having all the melodies as produced by Snaz. He's one of the top producers here. He produced a lot of, he's Drake's friend. He produced a lot of his early stuff. So I'm going to make that link because he always tells me that. And they're from the Western Road crew and when they were little. And that story and Jane South. So, you know, there's a lot of, it's just him being able to bring it out of me. I've recorded a lot more songs with him that have the same element that we didn't get on the album that we have on future projects. That he's a really good producer and he has stuff that are total opposite of that. So the fact that that track was the one that made me tell that story was deep, and I had to tell it, and it just fit. It was fitting for that first track on the record after Chuck. I was like, they forgot about me. Here you got Chuck introducing me, and I'm like, but they forgot about me, Chuck. Yeah, so I thought it was fitting to go right there on the album. First track, Forgot About Mish.
Was that the first track you wrote for the album, or?
No. It was just that when you hear the whole body of work and I put it together, it made sense because the whole album that I rant about my career, my going through this and going through that and, you know, just how artists tell their stories, that was the first one that hit me the hardest and saying, well, maybe they don't even know who I'm at. Let me tell them why they forgot about Mish and how they forgot about Mish or how I feel that they forgot about Mish right after the intro. Yeah, so it was fitting. And it was a storytelling. It was the intro than an intro. That I liked, and yeah, slow creeper.
I'm gonna jump around a little bit, but you know, you talk about this track, Forgot About Mitch, then on the track on Times Change, you spit, and it's only six words. I know how to count. Is I'm not mad anymore. I've matured. You know, what is the reference there? I mean, what is that moment that you realize that didn't make sense to be mad?
It doesn't. And that's the immature part of the artist in the business because we're such artists, we're such creatives, you know, we're such like, you know, as soon as you do it, we're like, does the world see it yet? You know, we're such, and now I can imagine this younger generation when they're like, they truly believe as they do it and post it, it's worldwide.
Right. Oh,
so, yeah. So my mental was getting used to this. They totally are entitled in their mind to it getting out. So it was me talking to myself and saying, times change, you know, change gonna come, no matter where you come from. It has to change at some point, even if you can't change where you come from. Well, you know the song.
Yeah.
Well, check it out on the record. But yeah, it's I've matured. You have to mature. And it's about time hip hop matured. And it's about time we see the maturity in hip hop on a mass level. Like, I need to see the elders come out and do some music. Rock and roll doesn't die, reggae music, dancehall doesn't die, the elder artists, they just go on older tours. Hip hop is maturing now. All the elder females that we spoke about today, all the younger ones, all of us, we have stories to tell. you know, we need some premenopausal stories. You need to hear the ladies with the attitudes right. when they're mature, right. different hormones, they're all there.
Well, it's also like, you can't be, you know, I'm 42, I think. I'm 42.
You baby.
I know,
baby.
Right? But it's like, you can't be like.
My little brother's face. I love you guys.
You can't be like.
You think I knew all the time. Yes, sorry.
No, but you know, it's a point where like, you can't, you can't. As a 42-year-old, I'm not relating to anything a 20-year-old. It's like, I'm going to go out for drinks with a friend tonight. I am probably going to be back in bed by 9 o'clock at night. You know, like, so like,
it's true.
So, it's like, all right. So I'm, you know, I don't, and also it's like, I don't, like, if I'm listening to like a 50-year-old dude talk about getting all these girls at clubs, I'm like, I don't believe you, you know?
Yeah, I know, right? You're like, I don't think that's true.
Yeah, yeah. Like, unless you're like, anyway. Actually, I want to ask you about, before we talk a little bit more about the record, you know, you, we're both at this time, right? Where we, you know, we used to buy cassette tapes as kids. We used to, you know, a record was made. You had to wait another year until the artist made another record. But now we're obviously in this culture where you make a record and the next question is, so what's next? You know, where do you see yourself in terms of like, what's the major change for you from your first record to this one, but also your approach to the business side of it?
Oh, definitely more in charge. No more taking advantage of me to the best of my ability. You're naive coming into the game, and worse, you're, you know, the first in the structures built around you. It's terrifying. Especially in hindsight, it's like, oh my God, it's evil. So it's just like, you know, I find my sense of humor real quick. And I'm truly an artist that appreciates the art. So it's hard to make the business mess with the art. And that's what I learned real quick. And that's my piece. My piece is in my art. So looking forward, I hired really cool people that I've known over the years. I've seen their work. So I know more of their resume more and all their prerequisites. I know everything about them in terms of the work mode and where I want to be. So you get to make better choices. You get to see things a lot clearer. So there is, that's why I say we need older artists too. It's not to like just, you know, poop on all the things that happened back in the day.
Right.
It's to show growth. It's to show that, you know, not everyone knew what they were doing. This is a very early time in the era when I came out. So now you just kind of, you know, you just get smarter and you want to help other people. You want to help those not go through the same pain or the same journey or the same, or enjoy the joy to the fullest and understand that that's a happy day.
Right,
you know, not everything is bad. These entitled kids will think like, yo, did you not giving me that? No, you got to work. And some of them work so hard and wonder, well, where's my, no, that's well done, but you got to do this. So there's levels to this, and there's a reason that's real. There's levels to this. So yeah, it was a lot of growing pains, but I'm glad that I'm at the age now where I can actually still do it and still be relevant and still kind of, instead of selling my songs, do them myself. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, a lot of people get older in the industry and want to sell songs, and I'm like, nah, I can still record them. Can I just do it? But the writing doesn't go away. So I'm looking forward to writing for others in the future.
That's so, you know, and what's incredible is that you, not just reading up about you, but even in the song, even Willing and Able, you show that you have this really vast array of influences, and not just hip hop influence, where you mentioned PE, but you also talk about Sade, you talk about Neil Diamond, you talk about Celine Dion.
Yes.
Can you kind of talk about, you've already talked about PE, but talk about how Sade and, you know, and Celine Dion.
And Anne Murray.
just like, also, it's also, it also speaks to more about, you also came up at the time, and you mentioned this earlier, that hip hop wasn't popular. You didn't know where it was going to go. And now hip hop is popular. So you actually have people who grow up who are influenced by rappers versus you being more influenced.
Yes, being influenced by my Neil Diamond.
By Neil Diamond.
And my Anne Murray. Okay. I love my Neil Diamond and Anne Murray. So back off, kids. It was what was being played in the house. It was what was, you know, brought peace at home, and we knew this came on, and you're like, everybody gotta be quiet. Or, you know, there's mom's throwing down her mixing digital skills. Before digital skills, it would felt digital, because like it's a whole different switch. So yeah, it went from gospel to, you know, from Mahalia Jackson and Murray real quick. So there's a lot of things that, just like, you know, Western movies influence the Caribbean a whole. If you go to, you know, specifically Jamaica, everyone's got a Western, a Western channel. They love cowboy movies back then. So it went with the music. Country music was big in our house. Conway Twitty was very big in our house. So those are the things that influenced us. So when it became a storytelling moment for me, I had a lot of things to gravitate to pull from that could influence me. And I wanted to reflect that on this album, saying this was what was mainstream. So this is what made, you know, created where we came from, and it may not be so much accepted as in the South Bronx, but it was what was in Canada and on radio. And when Celine Dion came out, I mean, I think Sony shut down everything and only made Celine Dion records. So that was a moment for us in Canada. So yeah, so these were my influences, and I wanted to name drop those things instead of, you know, name dropping to everything else. And I did a bit of it in Women Get It From in the Jamaican, when I went back and listed some women in reggae music, and all of that on this Bad Gal Revenge album. It was just me letting off where I'm from and what I've been through, all my influence in terms of dialect, to open up to other women in the world, that you can be from anywhere, you can have any influence, and you can make an album, and you can be any age.
So
Bad Gal Revenge.
To bite down true. Take a girl man through them session of two. Action. No.
I want to ask you quickly about a way we get it from. It's a dancehall reggae track. What is the, and it's just, that's what it is. It's like, there's no, it's, you don't switch up in it.
Yeah.
what's the significance of delivering it, the track for this particular, for this message in all reggae versus good saying, hey, can I just do it in hip hop?
Yeah, I felt like I kept switching it up back and forth, and I would always have people say, why aren't you doing a dancehall album? Do a rock album, do a hip, do all mish. And they wanted me to do a dancehall record through. So this was my one little, you know, I said, let the world see that I can do it. And I wanted it to be as the production to not overbear me and let you hear, A, the influences I just mentioned. I wanted to name drop, and I wanted them to hear that I could just, my audience to hear that I could deliver in full dancehall. And there's a lot more dancehall. I haven't really let that go yet. But, you know, I'm just watching and seeing, and I feel good with my writing. So, and I know this is a world where everyone's getting, especially in the West, you get a lot of help with the writing and the rig, but I'm glad to, I'm proud to say I'm still a full writer on my stuff. And I haven't gotten that, either that privilege or had that opportunity to have somebody write my stories as good as I do yet. So I look forward to, you know, but I am the writer.
I have a few more questions. Looking back at the music you've done so far in your career, is there a particular track that you kind of wish you could have, I guess, delivered it in 2021 for the people?
Well, there was tracks I put on here that definitely people didn't know. I had What You Talking About for a minute. I have another bonus track I'm putting on the CD. That's rock. I have a lot of rock and roll in me. So it was, even at the time when we did the rock and roll, we were like, no one's ready for that. And no one, I didn't think anybody wanted me to do, I don't know. Just a lot of mixing the rock with the dance hall all on one record.
Right.
Like doing this album is like, why are you putting, it's a mixtape. And then I could have made, I wanted it to be a mixtape. It was like, what? It is an album. So I got tired of, you know, the titles. So this is a very good example of me putting out tracks that the time is now.
I want to ask you this last question. It's based, I think a lot of times our career choices weirdly help us sometimes with parenthood. Because we deal with crazy people, and we're like,
yes,
kids are just as crazy. So you're, you know, so let's say you're a hip hop pioneer, dancer, reggae lover, radio, TV personality, actor, author, mentor. So besides motherhood, how did any of these hats help prepare you for motherhood?
Oh, man. My acting class was great. I knew how to come home and I'm like, I'm dad. No, I'm mom. No. Call me a mom. I'm grandma. Damn it. You listen to me. So my acting classes were great. Stage performance was a release. You go home, you're tired. You only want love and your loved ones around you. Hmm. So it all helped me prepare. It definitely did. And being a mother was the core of it because that helped me find patience. Hmm. And it helped me commit. It helped me focus, you know, grounded me. Like you can go, no, you can't. It's the embodiment of being a woman. That's why when I actually see the female MCs and they're not afraid to have their babies anymore. Mm-hmm. And there was a time where you'll see MCs were not trying to have female MCs were not trying to have kids. It was really a choice. When there was only a few of us that had children early back then, and we were damn near the outcasts at one point, you know, felt like we were. So the parenting now being a part of the culture or being accepted and talked about and interviewed and Instagrammed and everyone's got a page, you got a page, I got a, it's definitely encouraging that you can be a parent and do your job. And do in it, it helped. And you know, I'm not telling anybody go out there and make babies. Right. I mean, find your time, find the right person, find a mate for God's sake. But other than that, it really helped me mature and grounded. And you know, there's always someone else watching. Mm. There's always someone else watching, and that what you know, I never wanted to embarrass my child, so that kind of helped me grow up real quick.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. The parenting part of, you know, you of musicians, when you actually talk to them about being parents and they're just like, they're giving you like the best parenting advice in the world. And you just, it throws you back. And you're like, I just know you from your albums and you're this amazing parent. So that's right? Really cool. And to speak to your point, I mean, you realize how powerful, you know, the lyrics of, when Lauryn Hill and Zion talks about how the pressure to not have a baby, you know, and you realize, cause that pressure is real.
Yeah, and I think all Haffer's dreams are from me. All those views are me, Lauren. Yeah, Zion was my track.
That was great.
Oh my God, I felt it.
So the very last question, Michi, I do appreciate your time for this. This album, if you were to take a track that you think you're kind of your go-to song for this album, is there one particular track that you just kind of, you know, sit back and just play?
Oh man, that's a hard one. I start at the top and go all the way down, and it depends on my mood. There'll be a time where I just want to hear Made It. There'll be a time where I only want to hear Willing and Able. There's a time where I would just want to sit in dark and hear Forgot About Mish. And then there's a time where I'm getting dressed to put on makeup. I want to hear, where am I getting from? I'm in seven, where am I getting from? And, you know, I'm getting ready for the anywhere, for the living room, to Zoom. when I'm getting my Zoom action going, you know, I will play. And there's times where I just want to just, you know, disturb my neighbors and play What You Talking About. So my album is fully me. If you know, like, I hope everyone gets to know me and stay tuned for me. Yes. It's fully my entire, it embodies who I am all around. And I'm looking forward to share. I have three videos in the can that we shot before COVID. And the beauty of it was some of these places have been shut down. So we've immortalized them. So we're sharing the story, their stories with them, with my stories and our stories. So yeah. So I look forward to sharing the content. We've got like three hot videos coming out. I'm sure I'm going to make three more and keep it coming. Michi Me, Bad Gals Revenge. Stay tuned.
Hip Hop Pioneer, Michi Me, thank you so much for being on Library Rap, the Hip Hop Interviews with Tim Einekill. I greatly appreciate this.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate you. Thanks for having me, man.